Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Friday, October 1st. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ken Kaplan, reading for Harry Bruinius.
And I'm Samantha Liney Perfoss.
When Harry Bruinius was a student learning the profession of journalism over two decades ago, he had to report and write stories on Deadline that illustrated such topicless themes as altered states or remembrance of things past or overcoming obstacles. These exercises emphasized the necessary sinews that hold stories together as recognizable human experiences. They also emphasize the lenses reporters must choose when organizing the facts they find. In the Monitor's Finding Resilience series, he decided to seek out the ways some people responded to the COVID-19 pandemic. It was a very personal topic, since his neighborhood in Queens was among those experiencing the highest rates of infection in the world at the time, accompanied by fear and a surreal sense of uncertainty. A year and a half later, however, Mr. Bruinius didn't really find examples of resilience. Instead, he found a group of students in the Bronx who had already done the work, interviewing people who, unlike him, could not work from home. They documented on Zoom the stories of Bronx residents who often lived in multi-generational homes, worked in essential jobs in little protected conditions, and experienced a crisis in a borough with a long-observed dearth of healthcare facilities. As each of them told him, they expected these oral histories to be tales of hardship and woe. To their surprise, they said, they found instead resilience, a word their sources used again and again. And as they struggled too, learning the skills of interviewing and storytelling on the fly in the midst of the disruptions in their own lives, they found a measure of resilience in themselves as well. Join Mr. Bruinius and some of these students next week as the Monitor hosts a free online conversation on Tuesday, October 5th, titled Overcoming Adversity: How the Pandemic Revealed Resilience. To participate, register for the noon show or the 6 p.m. show. Now, today's stories. Our first story. For more than a decade, Europeans have looked to Germany's Angela Merkel to lead with unshakable ethics. Now, as she prepares to leave office, can France's Emmanuel Macron take up her mantle?
Angela Merkel is stepping down after 16 years as Germany's chancellor and Europe's most prominent head of state. It's leaving space for French President Emmanuel Macron to fill the power vacuum left in her wake. Mr. Macron has been a great promoter of Europe since his early days as the president of France, and it's been a top priority as of late, amid the pandemic, climate change, and geopolitical tensions with Russia and China. France has been actively trying to influence the EU's trajectory, says Georgina Wright of Institut Montaigne in Paris. A lot of what the EU is discussing at the moment are all the things France has been pushing and decisions close to Macron's heart. But Mr. Macron has not persuaded Europeans that he can lead them. A recent poll found that 41% of European Union citizens would vote for Ms. Merkel versus 14% for Mr. Macron in a hypothetical election for the EU presidency. Macron has failed to take other members of the EU on board. He is a leader with no followers, says Yana Pouglerin, a co-author of the study. He has ambitious ideas, but he needs to be more trustworthy and more inclusive, more like Merkel in this respect. The story was reported by Colette Davidson in Paris for The Monitor.
Germany's first post-Merkel election promises to reshape the country's governing priorities. They can begin to be seen as the parties thresh out a new, likely three-party coalition.
With Germany's federal elections finally in the books, The country's parties are now tasked with determining who will replace Angela Merkel as chancellor. For the first time in decades, three parties will be needed to form a governing coalition. The calculus that requires three parties to form a coalition gives unusual power to two smaller parties, the Greens, 14.8%, and the Free Democrats, 11.5%. These two parties, which are both socially liberal but divided on economics, will be hammering out policy differences and finding commonalities. Meanwhile, Olaf Scholz and his center-left Social Democrats, which edged Ms. Merkel's center-right Christian Democratic Union by 1.5 points, will be waiting for their phone call. Pundits predict that the most likely government will be a traffic light coalition, red for Social Democrats, yellow for Free Democrats, and green for, appropriately, the Greens. Still, the result is not a clear repudiation of the Christian Democratic Union's mainstream policies. A traffic light coalition would definitely be a move to the center-left, but it will be capped by the free market-oriented Free Democrats, says Aaron Allen with the Center for European Policy Analysis. Olaf Scholz is an experienced, competent politician, and I don't think he'll rock the boat that much. The story was reported by Lenora Chu in Berlin for The Monitor.
Society often treats formerly incarcerated people as broken. At the Free Minds Book Club and Writing Workshop, they help each other and themselves find healing.
When Craig Watson returned from prison, he had 22 years of catching up to do. Volunteers with the Free Minds Book Club and Writing Workshop helped him with practical things like finding his first job. But most important, the organization became an extended family that kept Mr. Watson from becoming another statistic. Every year, the United States releases 7 million people from jail and more than 600,000 from prison. Of the latter, more than two-thirds are rearrested within 3 years. Free Minds offers its 330 re-entry members workshops, coaching, counseling, group support, and connections to opportunities. Mr. Watson is one of 12 peer supporters guiding others through the emotional and logistical challenges of starting over after incarceration. That level of peer involvement is key to the success of re-entry, experts say. The prison system is designed to break ties, to separate the person who is incarcerated from their community, says Tara Libert, co-founder and executive director of Free Minds. She says that peer support does the opposite. They repair, restore, and create new community connections, which are essential to successful re-entry. For Mr. Watson, the dream is simply to do right by a young man. It's just rewarding. The story was reported by Erica Page in Washington for The Monitor.
What's the best way to stay buoyant in the face of challenges like climate change or declining towns? For musician and author Dar Williams, the key is a social contract she calls positive proximity.
Folk singer Dar Williams' literary lyrics, lauded by the likes of Joan Baez and Judy Collins, often explore how contrasting individuals meet heart to heart. Her characters find common ground across religion and gender. Her latest album, I'll Meet You Here, which debuts October 1st, posits that social connections can empower individuals to tackle global issues, such as climate change. If you have what I call positive proximity, which is the most basic contract of social trust, you recognize that living side by side with other people is beneficial, says Ms. Williams in a phone interview. You don't have to like them. You don't have to understand them all the time. But somehow, you can find your dovetailing interests. The new album's lead single, Today and Every Day, features a stop-motion animation music video in which individuals unite to tackle climate change. Ms. Williams says the message is a counterpoint to the doomy tenor of many environmental stories in the news. That puts us in the place of not doing anything because it feels so futile, says the songwriter. Optimism is a revolutionary posture right now. The story was reported by Stephen Humphreys for The Monitor.
Now, commentary from The Monitor's editorial board on democracy in the Middle East. It says something about progress in the Middle East that top Islamist leaders in Iraq and Tunisia are crying out for democracy in their Muslim countries. Their public faith in individual liberties and rights is a timely counterpoint to the hardening of Islamist rule in Iran and Afghanistan. In Iraq, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, a highly influential religious authority, has called on voters to participate in crucial parliamentary elections October 10th. He advised voters to select a candidate in their districts who is the most honest, who is interested in the sovereignty, security, and prosperity of Iraq. In Tunisia, where a democracy sprang up during the 2011 Arab Spring, the leading Islamist party, Ennahda, has led calls to reverse a power grab by President Kais Saied. In July, the former law professor seized near total power. On September 29th, Ennahda called on all political and civil society groups to defend representative democracy. Many people in the Mideast who live under an authoritarian or strict Islamic ruler are probably aware of these hopeful calls for democracy by Islamist leaders. Reconciling democracy and Sharia, Islamic law, is not always easy. But at least two countries are showing signs of hope that bear watching. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for ending your week with us. Come back on Monday when we'll be looking at the start of the Supreme Court's term, including a case that could define the court's legacy. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how when forgiveness seems an impossible task, we can let God's love dispel hurt, redeem wrongs, and impel peace, grace, and even sweet reuniting. You can find the poem in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton, Tara Adhikari, and Tomas Gonzalez.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.